Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome once again to Rainer Hirsch's Proms in the Pub. My name is Rainer Hirsch. I am a conductor and a comedian, and this is my podcast about the BBC Proms, but without the BBC. Now, what does a conductor do? No, really. What does a conductor do? The whole thing's a mystery. It's weird. There's this person standing in front of an orchestra who looks like they're doing something really important, yet hardly anyone knows what it is. Not even, I would venture, a lot of the audience that turns out to see the proms. Football managers pick the team, shout stuff from the sidelines, and appear on telly afterwards explaining their triumph or excusing their defeat. Conductors wave, point, put on their "this is so beautiful, I'm going to cry" face, get all the applause, and disappear, not even stopping to mumble, "Yeah, the trombone's done well. What's going on?" Couldn't the orchestra just do that on their own? Conducting is actually not hard. You could definitely do it too if you wanted. The initial outlay is low, nothing more than a stick plus some evening wear. The principles are easy peasy and you don't even have to read music, really. Entertainer Danny Kaye conducted whole concerts for years and couldn't read a note. "It's the only job that can be learned in an evening," said conductor Adrian Bolt. So if you've got an evening, know a local park where there's plenty of sticks and can dig out whatever you wore to your last funeral, you could be on your way. Consider the pleasures. A whole orchestra at your command, fusing that mass of musical talent into a single voice, to have them sweep and surge with a flick of your wrist. Your wrist! Oh, the glory, the ecstasy. Okay, there's going to be some work to do. You're going to have to learn how to throw tantrums in a variety of foreign languages. You will need to know all the instruments and where their players sit so that you can at least vent your rage in the right direction. Then there are decisions to be made. Baton or no baton? Mad hair or groomed precision? Cold clinician or heart-on-sleeve musical musketeer? The pitfalls are many. There is potential humiliation at every turn, but look on the bright side. Whatever happens, you will definitely be the most interesting person at dinner parties. Now, if you want to pick up some tips, study the species in its native habitat, there's no better place than the proms. Night after night, new blood steps up to do whatever it is they do. And over the last few weeks, I've watched a few of them myself. Last night, it was Simon Rattle, who stands like a giant curly-haired goldfish, mouth open, gulping. Stick waving, left hand pointing, he recited a truly magnificent Mahler Second Symphony. All 1.5 hours of it, from memory. How does he remember it all? Well, he's been doing it for almost 50 years. That's got to help. The night before, it was Grandee Zubin Mehta in front of the Australian World Orchestra, a kind of super orchestra drawn from musicians of all orchestras, whose unifying factor is that they are Australian, or failing that, have at least one Australian grandparent, or failing that, if the orchestra manager is desperate, know at least what an AVO is, and do a convincing upward inflection at the end of all their sentences. Zubin has been ill, for which genuine sympathy, but the effect has been to make his gestures even smaller than they used to be. His beat, one beautiful but hardly changing undulation, his left hand cupped permanently as if he were a magician trying to conceal a coin. His face unchanging, his demeanour unbending, you're bound to wonder what he's doing exactly, and would it make any difference if he stopped? Going backwards a week, Danish Thomas Dausgaard, or if you're Danish, Thomas Dausgaard. Danish always strikes me as a kind of Cockney version of English. People have watched a little bit too much EastEnders. Dausgaard, Dausgaard, it's a language that's been filleted. Thomas spoke to the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra in gestures ranging from kneading the basses to a start at the beginning of Ravel's La Valse, to twitching the smallest pizzicato so it landed exactly as he would want it. Is all that precision too much? It's certainly better for everyone keeping together and more interesting to look at. Purists say it's what the ears hear that counts, but I don't altogether agree. The orchestra experience is also a spectacle, and the conductor not only shows the orchestra who's on, but also can remind the audience where their attention should lie. At best, he or she can be the physical embodiment of the sound. Back a week or more, we had the Mahler Chamber Orchestra, who came on and did the Marriage of Figaro Overture on their own, and I thought played better doing that than when pianist Leif Ove Adsnes conducted them. Work that out. But for me, the definition of what it means to be a conductor happened at the end of the first week in the form of this episode's guest, Barry Wordsworth. Barry, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind me describing him thus, has never been one of conducting's jet-set big hitters. He's not part of the, if it's Sunday, this must be Seattle crowd, but quietly, reliably, and for over 50 years he's been directing deceptively difficult programmes that the International Brigade wouldn't, and possibly frankly couldn't, touch. He's not known for his Mahler symphonies, though he does those too, or the lesser-known works of Pierre Boulez, but ballet, show music, Strauss waltzes, stuff that has a nasty habit of stopping, starting, changing tempo and being damnably difficult to get right. For that, you need not only musicality, but also a cast-iron technique. So when the chief conductor of the BBC Concert Orchestra, Bramwell Tovey, sadly passed away this July, who did the Beeb call on to fill his shoes in the Music for Royal Occasions prom? Barry Wordsworth. A true promenade concerts hero, including a veteran of the 1993 Last Night. I was absolutely delighted when he agreed to join me in Proms in the Pub. Well, actually, he'd just come back from a stay in his holiday home in the vicinity of Toulouse in France, so maybe we should be talking about the Proms in the Pub.
So tell me, Barry, how is Brexit going for you in the, you know, man who owns this little hideaway in Calais?
Oh, from that point of view, it's a complete disaster.
Hmm.
I've had the house for 30 years now, and I bought it particularly because I was travelling a lot with my work.
Yeah.
So if I had a holiday, I just wanted somewhere I knew I could go and just crash.
All the stuff is there. Don't have to take anything.
Exactly.
You're chez toi.
Yes. And I could do it without planning. You know, I could suddenly wake up and think, oh, I've got 6 days free. I'll go to Pesh.
Yeah.
Of course, now everything's hedged around with all the 90-day rule and all that Schengen nonsense.
Yeah.
And I have actually once already had a 6-month visa, which was very easy to get and worked fine, and I'll do that again.
Yeah.
Quite soon. But it's still a question of having to plan everything, you know?
Yeah. And as regards work, Brexit, all that, how do you feel about that?
Oh, it's dreadful, isn't it? I mean, the London Orchestra's... A friend of mine in the RPO, management of the RPO, just told me about 6 months ago that it's now easier for them to send the orchestra to America than it is to send the band to Europe. And financially, this is terrible, because all the London orchestras, well, all the British orchestras, particularly the London orchestras, used to just hop over for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, do a few concerts, come back.
Yeah.
No, it's a disaster.
Absolutely.
It's everything is worse than it was.
Yeah.
As a result of this.
Let's start at the beginning. You were born in Worcester Park.
How did you know that?
Oh, I have my spies. But that rings a bell with me because I was born in Thames Ditton.
No.
It's on the same line.
There you are, you see.
Well, you can get to Worcester Park a few ways, more ways you can get to Thames Ditton, I think. But
yeah, when I lived in Cheam for all my childhood.
Yeah.
I was brought up in Cheam.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something we might talk about because... That's how I became a musician, actually. Anyway.
Yeah, so. And so your first experience of conducting, well, I mean, was, as I understand it, conducting the Messiah at school, which is very precocious of you.
God, you know so many things.
Well, I've done a bit of, you know, I have a man treading you around just for a few days. It's not much, it's not expensive, and especially now with Brexit, it's already... No, of course, there is something called the interweb, and I spend a bit of time, you know, trying to find out, you know, tell me about that. How did that happen?
Well, we'd been preparing the Messiah at school with the local girls' school.
Yeah.
And the music master, who was a fantastic musician and a very, very good supportive person to me, about 2 weeks before the performance, he fell ill, couldn't do it.
Toscanini.
So I went to the headmaster and said, because the headmaster got up at, you know, at the beginning of school, and said that day, and said that Charles Cleo is not very well, we're going to have to cancel the Messiah. So I was a prefect by then at the school, sixth form. And I went and knocked on the headmaster's door and I said,
"Excuse me, sir.
You don't need to cancel it. I'll
do it. I think I can do that performance of the Messiah, sir."
So that's what happened.
Extraordinary. I mean,
with Charles's approval, of course, because, you know, because he was, as I say, he was a tremendous supporter. That's another story we can tell, because that's how I became under the wing, if you like, of Sir Adrian. Because when my dad came home one day and said, "Oh, there's a concert over the road," because we lived opposite a swimming pool, and in the winter,
right, they drained it, boarded it over,
and it became concert hall.
Extraordinary.
And the LPO were down with Sir Adrian.
Adrian Bolt.
Yeah. And the next morning when I went into school, the first lesson was a music lesson. And so the end of the lesson, the music, Charles Cleal, I don't know, I said, "Wordsworth, come over here. I want to talk to you. What's the matter with you? Dreaming, looking out of the window, I can't get your attention. What's up?" And I explained to him that I'd been to this concert and I couldn't get it out of my mind, you see.
Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, well, I remember the main work was Enigma Variations.
Right.
And he said, "Oh, Charles said, Sir Adrian's a good friend of mine. I'll write to him for you." And I said, "You can't do that. You can't do it." "Yes, I will." And 2 weeks later, I got a note from his secretary saying, "Sir Adrian has received this letter from your music master. And when you next get a holiday at school, please let us know and come and see Sir Adrian."
Fantastic.
Just wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
What was he like?
He was a real Edwardian gent, it's the best way I can describe it. I mean, he was quite formal, but he had a sense of humour. Mm. Unbelievably generous with his time.
Yeah.
Every holiday, every time, you know, he said, "Oh, well, I'll send you my weekly plan of rehearsals, and anything you can get to, just let me know, and there'll be a pass for you at the stage door."
Fantastic.
Or the artist entrance or whatever. So I went to see him conduct. By that time, of course, he wasn't with the BBC. He was with the LPO and all of that. And that was just amazing. Just to, you know, bring the scores that you've been learning with you and we'll talk about them. And we only ever once got the stick out and sort of did 4-4 to each other and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time it was, "Oh, I see you've been doing Brahms. OK, let's talk about which symphony shall we talk about?"
Nice. He had this a very particular technique. He had this, you know, this way of, he wrapped rubber bands around a ball-y kind of baton, didn't he?
Yeah, I've got some upstairs.
Have you?
Not of his, but I've got the sort of thing. It's a very good idea because it, you know, so often, even if it's a cork handle,
yeah,
it slips out of the hand, well, especially when you get a bit sweaty.
That is traditional.
And the elastic bands just hold it there. You've got a good grip.
His thing was, I think, be able to roll it around in your finger like that.
Yes, it was all
so like
it was all
rolling
really
up down. So you had this, like a rolling a golf ball up and down, and being able, therefore, the baton, the pointy bit, would move around with you. And
yes,
be flexible.
And you didn't have to move this. Bring your arms up once a concert was his advice.
Yes,
you know, the rest of the time, yeah, he was an extraordinary man. I mean, for example, the very last thing he said to me, he said, "You seem to have grasped hold of quite a lot of it. Now go away and forget it all and find your way of doing it." And it wasn't for years I realised what he meant, you know, that it's such a personal thing. There isn't a right or a wrong way, is what he would sort of say. "Well, try this, or maybe that would suit you better." Or
meaning physical language.
Physical, and also to do with the interpretation of music and what you're there for.
Mm.
I mean, that's one of the first, when I first went to see him, he used to call me Wordsworth, of course. What do you think you're there for, Wordsworth? And I said, "Because I like music." So I said, yes, I know, but I mean, what are you supposed to do for the orchestra? I said, "Oh, I don't know, really." You know, I was only about 9 years old. And he said, "You're there to do what they can't do for themselves. Most of it they could do without you. Just concentrate on the things they really need you for."
Right. And for the uneducated, as if to a 5-year-old child, what do the orchestra need you for?
Well, I think partly his view was that these days the orchestra is so large, conductors weren't needed originally because they could all keep together quite well nicely.
Back in the day of Mozart and the like.
Yeah.
20 people, they don't need a conductor.
Exactly.
They can see one another, they can hear one another, they don't need somebody waving the stick in front of them just to go, this is where the beat is or whatever.
That's it. So you have to find a way of being keeping the thing together.
So when you spread that out to, you know, 120 people, then all of a sudden people can't hear one another, they can't see one another.
Exactly. That's and also in certain concert halls, they hear an echo, or they hear this or that and the other, which they don't realise.
Mm.
So you point out to them that this is needs a bit of attention or whatever. And he was also, although he didn't hardly ever spoke about intonation, but he did say, you know, sometimes they will need to know if it's not as in tune as you think it should be or so. But, you know, just mention it, let them deal with it.
Mm.
So he was very... I mean, he was a very forceful character, but he didn't... He was never a dictator of the orchestra. Never.
Yeah, yeah. Very hands-off.
Mm.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, get the orchestra... The orchestra will sort things out on their own. That's the main thing about it. They, the first run-through, they cock it up. The second run-through, suddenly it's better already just by dint of having played it again.
Yeah. And he was also quite... You know, he... He would say, "Well, we have a good system of notation, but it's not the bees, you know, it's not the end of the world." And you've got one rehearsal, and you have to make sure that everybody's thinking about the piece you're doing in a similar sort of way. It may not be the way they'd like it to be, but that's how we're going to do it today.
Yes.
So you know we're there. Well, I mean, he used to say to me, "You're a primus inter pares."
Ooh,
first amongst equals.
Okay, there we go. If I'd read more, you know, spy novels, I'd know that. Tell me about the first time you attended a Proms concert. Can you remember that?
I can't tell you the date.
No, just roughly what age you might have been.
Yeah, I think I was in my teens, still at school, and I remember because it was before the Mushrooms.
Right.
I remember hearing the concert twice. Once from the platform and once from the bounce on the, from the wall behind me.
Yeah.
And isn't it wonderful what they've done to that acoustic now?
Well, it's been up there a while now. I actually can't really remember it. That was 1968 or something.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, it was an amazing place to go just because, it, you know, whenever I went, it was always packed full, even then. Or perhaps particularly then. And it has a wonderful atmosphere. I adore the place. But, I mean, now the sound is just... Wonderful.
Right. So you your first concert, can you remember what you saw, anything like that? Anybody from those years?
No. I can't really remember except that I came home thinking, oh, God, this is amazing.
This is the world I've got to be in.
Yeah.
Now you have conducted 30 times at the Proms. Were you aware of that?
No, I didn't realise that.
30 times. So, you know, you first did it in 1987.
Mm.
Do you remember that?
Can you remind me what the programme was?
I can remind you what the programme was. The programme was Tchaikovsky, Eugene Onegin, Polonaise from, Waltz from Act 2, Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto with Howard Shelley, and Poulenc, Les Biches, the complete ballet, a Proms premiere.
Wonderful. Well, I think I must have had quite a hand in that. Because Les Biches is a score that I absolutely adore.
Yeah.
And we were doing it around that time, I think, at Covent Garden anyway. Or I had done it as a ballet. So, yes. Well, now you've reminded me, I can remember how wonderful it was to do that prom.
So the phone goes, or maybe back in 1987, the runner comes round. Or maybe it's a little street urchin. I've got a letter from Mr. Wordsworth, sir. And then here's a half a crown for your trouble. It probably would have been half a crown back then. No, it wouldn't. We're not there. And... Wait, now, what happens then? You know, it's the Proms, this thing you've been to
mm-hmm.
As a teenager. How did that feel?
Usually, I think when you get asked to do a concert, there's already an idea in people's minds about what it could be.
Mm.
And then you have this wonderful discussion backwards and forwards. Well, supposing we swap that piece, would this piece be better? Could we do that? And eventually you come to a version of the programme which everybody's happy with.
Right. So that's where your biche mores would have come in.
I imagine it might have been my idea, especially if it was a Proms premiere, but then they would have been very keen to have a piece like that done for the very first time at the Proms anyway.
Why do you like Les Biches?
Oh, I love the style of Poulenc, the sort of... He's a composer that I would love to have met, because apparently his character was extremely changeable. Some days he could be absolutely wonderful company, and other days a real pain in the neck. So... and there's that sort of hint of something slightly sinister in the score, whilst at the same time being quite beautiful music to listen to. It's the variety of of styles, and it must have been with the BBC Singers then.
It was.
So yeah, there we are.
BBC, a bit Uncle Tom Cobley and all were out there.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tell us what it's like. You walk out onto that platform, to that audience. What's that like?
I think it's a terribly complicated question, actually. I mean, it should be a simple answer to that. First of all, there's the thrill of the place being practically full. So what is that, 5,000 people?
Yeah.
I mean, how often do you do a concert to that many people?
Bear in mind, the Festival Hall is only 2,200, and that is rarely full. So
there we are.
You've got twice that.
Twice that. And an
nightly.
Nightly, and an enthusiasm, which I don't think I've... Well, yes, I did do a concert recently where the enthusiasm of the audience was... as was on that level, but it is something extraordinary at the Albert Hall, and it's the same night after night, isn't it? That people, it's still the greatest music festival in the world, actually. So, and I think that if you have any nerves, and I do still get nervous about doing concerts, the moment you begin, it all disappears, and you can just focus on what you're there to do.
Mm.
And that, for me, is the most wonderful thing.
Why do you get nervous? What's jumping around in your mind? What are the demons saying to you?
I think it's because you have a head full of things that you want to achieve, and you're just hoping that you will achieve them.
Hmm.
Nervousness is probably the wrong word. It's tension. That's a better way to describe it.
Right.
I'm sure that walking onto the platform should never feel the same as you do when you go into a supermarket. You know, there's an excitement, but there's also a responsibility that you have to make things work for your orchestra, for the audience, for your soloists. You want to give everybody a jolly good time, don't you?
Mm. You don't want things to go wrong.
Absolutely not.
In what mode might they go wrong? What's the thing that you fear happening?
It's partly why I never conduct from memory, because I have seen some very great conductors do things from memory and actually make mistakes.
Mm. Like cue people in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Forget whole movements.
Exactly. You know, things that the orchestra have saved them. But there's usually a hiatus moment and that happens.
Orchestra saving them in the sense that the orchestra, of course, they've got the parts in front of them and they would ignore this very inviting gesture to start playing knowing that they've still got, you know, four bars rest or whatever it is.
Yes, I mean, I'm not going to mention any names. But I have seen conductors bring in a fortissimo two bars too early, you know. Repeated passage in a classical symphony where suddenly they've lost their concentration for a moment. And the orchestra just goes on playing what's in the parts. And you can see sometimes an odd smirk on somebody's face. So if you're saved by the orchestra, that's wonderful. But, I mean, there are times when you can lead them up the garden path if you're not on the ball.
In what way?
Perhaps in Stravinsky, for example, conducting a 5-8 the wrong way round, or getting lost.
Hang on a second, let's unpack that. So a 5-8 would be five beats in a bar, and it could be either 3-2 or 2-3.
Yeah.
And that actually, strangely, so you boot three beats down and two beats up, or the other way around. And that, strangely, can be quite important to players who are trying to deal with Stravinsky Rite of Spring, for example.
Yes, because, and we go back to what we were talking about earlier, it is an enormous orchestra.
Mm.
What's it, 100 and something players usually?
Mm.
So the actual distance between one side of the orchestra and another is such that they can't hear each other.
Mm.
And they rely on you to place things in the right way. And in such a way that they will respond to the beat and produce the sound together.
Yeah. But there you are on that famous podium. And you are the centre of this vast arena, the biggest audience that generally, you know, most people will perform to, unless they've done the Hollywood Bowl, and who knows, that's probably smaller. Do you ever allow yourself a moment to look around and think, my goodness, you know, if that teacher, the headmaster who let me conduct Handel the Messiah, could see me now? Is there anything like that? Even a moment?
I think possibly after the concert's over, I might have those thoughts. And certainly walking out there before the rehearsal starts in the afternoon, you think, how many other great, great conductors have walked along the pathway that I'm now working on and stood on that rostrum? You know, starting with Henry Wood.
Yeah.
I find that if I think about that too much, it the stress level goes up again. So I just try and concentrate on what I'm doing.
Yeah, you zone it out a little bit. So you conducted it first in 1987, and then every year for 20 years, pretty much. Sometimes, well, not pretty much, yes, every year for 20 years. Sometimes more than once in a season. I'll just go over some of your hits, if you don't mind. Because you're a man who's done so many concerts, so many great things. In 1995, you did the 100th anniversary of the first Promenade concert. So they started in 1895.
Yeah.
And you did the 100th. In one programme, in 1994, I counted 19 pieces of music you had to conduct. You know, there's a bit of Strauss, and then there's some operas, and then there's some opera arias, and then there's, you know, some phonic piece, and then there's this and that. That isn't it. That is a vast, you know, you have to switch styles and moods so quickly.
Yes, I think that they're possibly, a little bit of influence from Friday Night Is Music Night on Radio 2.
Yeah.
You know, there was almost never a piece in Friday Night in my day, which lasted for more than 6 minutes. So that people listening at home on Friday night, if they didn't like it, they wouldn't turn the radio off because they know that it'd be over in a minute and they'd have the next thing that they would enjoy.
Yes.
And I think that that's possibly part of the influence of this, because all those, most of those problems were with the concert orchestra, weren't they?
Yes, all of them, I think.
Yeah.
The BBC Concert Orchestra, who in 1993 you described as the gypsies from Golders Green, I believe. Maybe it'd be the travellers from Golders Green now. I don't know.
Yes. Yes, that was in their speech, wasn't it? At the last night of the Proms. Well, it's still, for me, one of the great, great orchestras.
Right.
And
because they can change direction so quickly.
And also, even when they're playing something which perhaps some of them are not so keen on, you would never know when you're conducting. The actual determination to play the piece as it should be and to give their best for whatever is put in front of them is just the most inspiring thing to work with, I have to say. I mean, there are other, I'm not saying other orchestras don't do it, but the concert orchestra do it every day of their lives.
You then proceed with 20 years of Proms. Some names that I noticed that you worked with, 1989, Richard Rodney Bennett. Do you remember him?
Yes, I do very well, because we had the... Well, I had the most exciting time working with him on a ballet at Covent Garden called Isadora, another choreography by Sir Kenneth MacMillan. And he used to come along to rehearsals, and at the end of a day working with him, he'd say, "What are you doing now?" "I'm playing, tonight I'm playing at the Pizza on the Park." And he would go down, you know, and croon and play Scott Joplin and croon into the piano and sing. And this was a guy who'd studied composition with Pierre Boulez. I mean, what a fantastic musician. And also, I have to say, a really nice bloke. Mm. And so I was thrilled to be able to do some performances of his.
Yeah.
Poems.
Julian Bream playing
The
Malcolm Arnold Guitar Concerto.
Yes, that was an experience too, not least because, as you probably know, Malcolm Arnold is quite a character.
Yes, one way of describing it.
And I do remember at the end of the performance, because I think he was quite pleased with the performance. He wasn't so pleased with the rehearsal. And he kept on stopping us and saying, "No, that's not right, and that's not right." And I remember Julian Bream suggesting that whoever was with Malcolm at that time would perhaps take him off for a coffee. "Perhaps it's time you had a coffee, Malcolm." And they took him away, and then we or something. and then we got on with the rehearsal. But at the end of the performance, he was obviously pleased with what we'd done, and he picked up Julian's guitar and threw it into the air. I mean, he let go, and I mean, it just went up, and he caught it again as it came down and gave it back to him. And I mean, you heard the whole orchestra and the audience just gasp.
This is
horror.
On stage?
Yes, on stage.
In front of?
In front of everybody. I mean, we were all like, I'm sure there's a tape of it. You can probably hear the whole of the Albert Hall going, "Ah!" as he did it.
How extraordinary.
Well, he was rather a wonderful character.
Well, I suspect Julian Bream didn't think so at that precise moment, because his guitar, a lovingly, probably handcrafted, you know, Spanish, you know, probably worth a bit.
I would have thought so, yes. Well, thank goodness it came back in one piece.
We'd be telling a different story. We'd be telling about, you know, the day that you were there when Julian Bream's guitar got smashed.
And we had to get the broom out and sweep up the bits. Yeah, that would have been fun, wouldn't it?
That is the title of an biography, isn't it? Malcolm Arnold smashed my guitar, Julian Bream. Now, one problem that we cannot ignore was 1993, when you did The Last Night.
I remember being, in the preparation of it, being absolutely overawed by the idea that it was going to be me doing this. You know, how can this be possible? But then thinking immediately, OK, so you have been asked, now get on with it and do the best you can. And the excitement. I mean, there is, again, more excitement even walking into the last night of the proms because of all the history and tradition of that situation than there is about even about an ordinary night, which is exciting enough. But to walk out of that stage on the last night, it's just something else. And it really makes you give of your best, I think. One hopes.
Yes. Do you feel the butterflies that night, the doubt?
Well, again, it's exactly the same. Yes, beforehand. But the moment you start, your brain is so into what you're doing that all the anxiety and the stress and that disappears.
Yeah. Do you get paid more for the last night?
No.
No, just like another concert.
Just like another
it is
one.
The BBC.
It's a BBC fee, yes.
But maybe a bit more for the broadcast. But probably not as
no,
good.
No, that's
as...
all included.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, no.
Do you still get repeat fees? Because I occasionally get repeat fees for ludicrously small sums, like 58p. And
yeah, it's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah, it helps.
Fund my, whatever it is, my slipper habit. Now, yeah. In that last night, your speech, there, which one can watch on YouTube, it's still there?
Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, it's my turn. I have been told that this was going to be an ordeal, but I think I might rather enjoy it. Can you believe we are nearly at the end of the 99th Henry Wood season of Promenade Concerts?
You talked about... well, I want to contrast what it was like in 1993 with what's happening now. You talked about, you know, how wonderful it is as 83% attendance. Well, it's hard to know because who gets the figures? Only the BBC. But all reports indicate that it's gone significantly down after COVID.
Yes.
There is obviously COVID. Do you think COVID has changed people's attitudes, you know, towards going to live events and the concert hall?
I do. I think people are very nervous about it. Mm. I think also that just the fact that they've got out of the habit of travelling and going to a concert, getting home late, I think as people have gotten used to sitting at home listening to it on the radio and not travelling. But I think as time goes by, it could return. I like to think it will because actually... one of the most wonderful things about music making is the social aspect of it.
Yeah.
It's not the same if you listen on your own or with a couple of friends at home. It's really not that. There is something missing, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that people will realise that, and slowly it will come back. But it's going to take a lot of hard work to persuade people of that missing element.
In your speech, you wondered whether the BBC was as proud of the resources represented on that stage as clearly the Proms and you and everybody else were. Mm-hmm. In the sense that there is a sort of disconnect between the authority of the BBC, the great mass of that, and the artistic undertaking that are the BBC orchestras. And so it's not a question of, you know, one person, John Drummond, for example. It's the powers that be up there. Do you think the BBC is still as proud in 2022 as they were in 1993?
I'm very much out of the situation, the BBC situation now. I've still got a title, as you know, with the Concert Orchestra Conductor Laureate, but I don't get involved at all in politics of it. Not only because I don't want to, but because it doesn't happen. People don't need to ask me. There are other principal conductors and so on involved in all of that sort of thing. So what I have to say is just looking at it from the outside.
Absolutely, that's what I mean. It's your own view.
My own view. Yeah. I'm worried because I keep hearing that the BBC licence fee is going. I keep hearing that, for example, the BBC Concert Orchestra might be relocated. If those things happen, will the funding still be there for the five orchestras that the BBC finance? My mind is full of question marks, and I would be devastated if the BBC orchestras went. I think it would be the most terrible thing for this country. But people are so passionate about the orchestras that perhaps if that did happen, they would find a way of surviving, just exactly the same as the Australian orchestras survived when the ABC decided to stop the funding. So who knows which way it will end up, but I have a feeling that the orchestras will survive.
Yeah. You also said that in 1927, when the BBC took over the Proms, it was entrusted with something, a jewel, which it needed to value and protect.
Mm.
Is it doing that?
Yes, I think it is. It may not always seem to everybody that it's going in the right direction, because the important thing about it is that it develops. So it shouldn't be the same now as it was 20 or 30 years ago. It has to. And I think that the people who run the Proms are very conscious of that. And the variety that I saw in the programming, it's over there, it's wonderful. Of course, there are the post-COVID problems, and the fact that it's been for 3 years now, yes, influenced by those difficulties, is very, very difficult for everybody. And it's very easy just to observe from the outside and say, oh, of course, it's a load of rubbish compared with what it was. And I've heard people say that. I don't believe that at all. I think it's still an enormously vibrant force. And I think the clever thing is that it changes in order to maintain that vibrancy, because if you keep it as it was at the original, then nobody would bother to go at all. It has to evolve.
Yes, and it's the change that people don't like. I mean, that's one thing about all audiences everywhere. They get used to one thing and they want it to remain the same. But in fact, therein lies the end of the road, so to speak.
I think it's... Yes, I agree with you, and I think it's terribly important that we realise that music is there for everybody. It's the most powerful ingredient of good that we have in society, or one of the most, shall I say. And that isn't just classical music. That's music of every style, from every background. And it's a wonderful way that people start to understand each other. You know, if you listen to classical music from all over the world, you're a richer person.
You also mentioned, you know, and this is going beyond the BBC, that you hope those responsible in government supported our musical heritage so it's in a good condition for, talking in 1993, the new millennium. Here we are, 30 years after that. Has the government fulfilled that promise?
I think it could do better. I really do. And I'm saying this, aren't I, at a time when musicians the world over have been through the most appalling 3 years of insecurity, doubts. And I think that it would be wonderful if we felt that the support was there from the government for our great symphony orchestras. Let's hope, as things progress forward, that we get more of that, because the finances, I think, are in pretty dodgy state.
Yeah. Finally, you talked in that speech about having had attended the Proms 35 years previously as a young whippersnapper. Mm-hmm. 1993, whizzing through the maths. I know you were born in 1948, is that right?
Yeah.
Who would you wait all afternoon in line for and stand for 2 hours to see these days? Is there anybody that you think, if at the time I go to their concert? Bear in mind, I'm phrasing this from the point of view of a stand-up comedian, and there is no worse audience for a stand-up comedian to perform in front of than an audience of stand-up comedians who sit at the back going, interesting material, good jokes, yeah. Musicians, in my opinion, tend to be slightly more open than that, but answer that. Is there anybody out there you think, I would like to see them do something?
Oh, gosh. I'm I'm more interested in choosing programmes that I go to see because of the music that's involved rather than the personality that's playing it, which may be slightly strange, actually. We have so many wonderful soloists, don't we, in the world? And the world of music is now such an international scene. I am more and more impressed by the variety that we have. People that come and play here from all over the world. I would never not go to a concert because it was that soloist. So it probably means that I would go to whatever, as long as it was a piece that I really wanted to hear. But of course, that's a limiting thing to say, because, you know, there's more music out there that I don't know than I do know. The repertoire of the world of music is enormous, isn't it? If you listen to it your whole life for 12 hours a day, you'd never hear it all. So aren't we lucky?
Barry, thank you so much for spending time. This is Proms in the Pub. What are you drinking?
Shall we have a little glass of Prosecco to celebrate our wonderful conversation?
Absolutely. I think Prosecco, given your French tendencies, it's got to be champagne.
Okay, let's do that. Glass of champagne.
Barry Wordsworth, a true gent and one of those people who makes you feel special, like you've somehow done him a favour by talking to him. The truth, of course, is completely the other way round. Thank you again, Barry. A reminder that you can listen to his Music for Royal Occasions prom via BBC Sounds until the 10th of October, or if you live in the UK, watch it on the BBC iPlayer, where it will be available until the middle of 2023. Still more to come in four more episodes of Rainer Hirsch's Proms in the Pub before the end of the 2022 prom season, including some surprises like, yes, the moment I bumped into Proms in the Pub hero Tom Serbis outside the Albert Hall Labs when he said this.
And one final thing, would you be so kind as to say, Rainer Hirsch's Proms in the Pub is the place to hear about the proms or something?
Rainer Hirsch's Proms in the Pub is the place to hear about the proms.
And some other things, including telling me how I could improve my Tom Serbis impression. Fierce joy. Meantime, our regular, very special guest, Harry the Piano, has been contemplating Barry Wordsworth's ballet stylings, and that took some saying, the world of light music, and come up with this version of Tchaikovsky Nutcracker, doing the light fantastic. Until next time, music, maestro, please.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.